Good evening. Hurricane Dorian becomes a monster with Florida in its sights. As the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks nears, is Trump failing in Afghanistan? And marijuana and politics as legalization comes closer to reality in New York State. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Friday, August 30th, 2019. Hurricane Dorian is about to sweep a corridor of some 10 million people, with Walt Disney World and President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in its path. It has the potential to become the most powerful storm to hit the state's east coast in nearly 30 years. Dorian strengthened into an extremely dangerous Category 3 hurricane in the afternoon and was expected to become a potentially catastrophic Category 4 with winds of almost 140 miles per hour or 225 kilometers per hour before blowing ashore late Monday or early Tuesday. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis had these words.
As you know, we have a state of emergency issued in Florida for all 67 counties. The precise path of the storm is still somewhat uncertain, and that's the reason for all 67. But the intensity of the storm, I think there's a pretty high degree of certainty that this is going to be a major hurricane, Category 4 potentially, and Category 4 plus. Yesterday, we submitted a request to the federal government for pre-landfall declaration for assistance for protective measures. We anticipate getting a positive response on that. That request has been endorsed by all the entire Florida delegation in the U.S. Congress, and we appreciate them for their support on that. Floridians need to be prepared. The bad news of the storm going slower is that could potentially have some negative impacts once it reaches landfall. But you do have time before it reaches to prepare if you have not done so. And so we urge all Floridians to have 7 days worth of food, medicine, and water. This is potentially a multi-day event where it will churn slowly across the state. That obviously creates a whole host of issues. But if you're in an area that has an impact from this storm, you should assume you're going to lose power. If you're in an area that flooded during Hurricane Irma and you're impacted by this, you should assume that you're going to see flooding again after this storm. So be prepared, and be prepared for potentially a multi-day event.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The National Hurricane Center's projected track showed Dorian hitting around Palm Beach County, where Mar-a-Lago is situated, then moving inland over the Orlando area. But because of the difficulty of predicting a storm's course this far out, forecasters caution that practically all of Florida, including Miami and Fort Lauderdale, could be in harm's way. Trump declared a state of emergency in Florida and authorized the Federal Emergency Management Agency to coordinate disaster relief efforts. The hurricane season typically peaks about mid-August and late October. One of the most powerful storms ever to hit the U.S. was on Labor Day, 1935. The unnamed Category 5 hurricane crashed ashore along Florida's Gulf Coast on September 2nd. It was blamed for over 400 deaths. And President Trump's prized Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida could be directly in the path of Hurricane Dorian. The resort, currently closed for the summer, is on the wealthy barrier island of Palm Beach. Mar-a-Lago, which dates from the 1920s, was built by serial heiress Marjorie Meriwether Post. Trump bought the place in 1985. In 2005, Trump said he received a $17 million insurance payment for hurricane damage to the resort, but an investigation found little evidence of large-scale damage. When Dorian appeared headed to Puerto Rico, Trump tweeted, "The American island is one of the most corrupt places on earth." Those sentiments led many Trump critics to publicly hope the storm steers towards Mar-a-Lago, although that would also mean disaster for nearby middle-class and low-income neighborhoods. Meanwhile, local governments across Florida, including in Palm Beach County, are gearing up to deal with rising sea levels and possibly more intense hurricanes. If sea level rise predictions, even at the lower end, come to pass, Mar-a-Lago could have ocean water lapping on its lawns in the not-too-distant future. In international news, the Defense Department says a U.S. Special Forces soldier died during combat operations in Afghanistan on Thursday. He was the 18th U.S. soldier to die in that country this year, the third this week. On Wednesday, Master Sergeant Luis F. De Leon Figueroa, 31, and Master Sergeant Jose J. Gonzalez, 35, were killed during combat operations in Faryab province, located in the far northwest of Afghanistan along the border with Turkmenistan. Those deaths came on the same day the Taliban and U.S. diplomats reportedly resumed peace negotiations in Qatar. U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad met one-on-one with the Taliban's lead negotiator, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. The U.S. and the Taliban have held several rounds of negotiations in the past year on issues including a U.S. troop withdrawal, a ceasefire, and Taliban guarantees that Afghanistan will not be a launchpad for global attacks. More than 2,400 U.S. service personnel who have died since the U.S.-led invasion in 2001 to topple the government that harbored al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Trump says he wants to bring home at least some of the 13,000 troops he says remain in Afghanistan before next year's election. But the prospect of a U.S. pullout has created widespread concern. Another civil war in Afghanistan could follow as various armed parties jostle for power. The Taliban control roughly half of Afghanistan at their strongest since the 2001-led invasion and dismiss the current government as a corrupt puppet of the United States. Recently, ISIS stepped into the fight with a bombing at a wedding that killed dozens. Boston University political science professor Netta Crawford is author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars. She says while most of the killing started with the United States invasion, it's now becoming more widespread and the targets are changing.
But also they're targeting police because the police are working with the Afghan government. So a large number of Afghan police have been targeted by the militants, and then therefore they have to keep recruiting, but people don't necessarily want to go to work in an organization where they're going to be killed. So there's a constant battle to keep recruitment levels and police forces high. So it's a very fluid situation. And over time, the United States has changed its rules of engagement so it would kill fewer civilians. Civilian deaths then go down, but then there's a relaxation because of the concern about increased militant activity and civilian deaths go up. So you see some fluctuation in the number of civilians killed and how they're killed. We made a mess. We've participated in a war that's led to more than 40,000 Afghan civilian deaths. As I said, the police are targeted by militants. When the United States withdraws, they will be targeted. They're probably not capable of defending themselves without a lot of civilian casualties. So the fighting will probably intensify unless there is a political solution that includes the Taliban and the government and all other actors in an agreement which people will decide to stick to. Many more American soldiers have been injured and killed in the post-9/11 wars than individuals died in the Twin Towers and at the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. There's no reason to continue the killing. What we have to do is stop saying an eye for an eye. We have to stop the wars and to come to political agreements that people are capable of maintaining peace through law, the rule of law, not the rule of force. What we've done is made a grave error in attacking Afghanistan and trying to change their form of government and installing a government that is one of the most corrupt in the world, and then expect it to have legitimacy and function when we've been sort of constraining them and holding their hands and funding them, just sort of leave them on their own. The first mistake in this latest round of negotiations is not to have the government there. So it's just the Taliban and the United States and any other, I don't know exactly who's at these secret talks, but the Taliban is negotiating directly with the United States. The government should be there. So when there's an agreement announced in the next few weeks, it will not be one that will be legitimate. Not that this current government is in Afghanistan is tremendously legitimate, but it won't be a legitimate agreement, in my view. It won't be perceived as legitimate, that is, according to good procedures. And the Taliban government will be sort of left to their own devices. So we'll either have to go back in there and rescue what is semi-quasi-democracy limping along, or we'll leave it alone. The United States and the government have lost more territory in the last few years. They control less and less of it. Then they expect somehow to try to leave the Afghan government to control something. It's really hard to overstate how badly this has been handled. The idea that you could have these negotiations without all the parties there is a mistake. So I think there's a significant error there. Secondly, I don't think President Trump really understands what his military is doing. Or it's not even his military, the military that we pay for with our taxes is doing. For example, when he said that he could end all of this in Afghanistan by dropping many bombs and killing tens of thousands of people, he didn't understand that at the same time he's got a negotiation going on that is meant to end the war. So I don't really know how to take the president. This administration and previous administrations have had policies which are often doing one thing on one hand, and on the other thing, the next thing that they're doing is undermining that thing that they were doing on the first hand. There was an opportunity in October 2001, before the United States began war, to extract Osama bin Laden and put him on trial in some form. And the United States said that was inadequate. I think if we had that decision to make again, I think we'd make a different decision.
Boston University political science professor Netta Crawford is author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars. Afghanistan was the world's deadliest conflict in 2018, and the United Nations has said more civilians died there last year than in the past decade. Over 32,000 civilians have been killed in Afghanistan in the past 10 years. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Closer to home, at a time when more than 30 states in the District of Columbia have legalized the use of marijuana for either medical or recreational use, the U.S. Surgeon General says no amount of the drug is safe for teens, young adults, and pregnant women. Surgeon General Jerome Adams spoke at a news conference on Thursday.
Thursday, I released a Surgeon General's advisory saying that pregnant women and young people should not be using marijuana. And everyone said I was fear-mongering. But this is my lived experience in addition to where the science is taking us. And I want you all to understand, this is not fear-mongering. I hope that whatever your feelings are on marijuana and adult usage, and I got some strong feelings about that, too, from a public health point of view. But I hope we can all agree that no young person, no pregnant woman should be using marijuana. Right. And that's really what my advisory is all about. And Kevin mentioned this, and Wilson's up here, too, and he's the expert in this. But marijuana, 1995, strains of marijuana tested were about 4% THC. And I'm speaking to a crowd that is very educated, but just so everyone's on the same page, THC is the component of marijuana that causes euphoria, causes intoxication, and causes most of the documented harmful effects of marijuana, including addiction. 4% in 1995. In 2014, the strains that were tested were up to 14%, three times as strong. That was in 2014. The average dispensary now is putting out marijuana that's in the 20% THC, so five times more potent than the strains that people think of when they think of marijuana. As I said yesterday, you know, I'm still waiting for the memes to come out there, but folks are talking about it. They were talking about it on GMA, on Good Morning America, on CNN, on NPR. I said this yesterday. This ain't your mama's marijuana. Yeah. It ain't your mama's marijuana. We're talking about 25% stronger THC content in the plant, or 5% stronger, 25% in the plant form. And then you look at oils, you look at waxes, you look at shatter, you look at people vaping this, and they can get 75, 80, 90% THC delivery to the brain. This is like the difference between me saying, I'm okay with you having a 12-ounce light beer or a glass of wine to go to sleep, and me saying that I'm okay with you drinking a pint of vodka every night to go to sleep. That's the difference in potency we're talking about here, and we really have to understand that as we're having a conversation about marijuana use, that we recognize that we're talking about a fundamentally different product that is particularly dangerous to the developing brain.
And that is Surgeon General Jerome Adams speaking at a news conference on Thursday. Meanwhile, in New York State, a law signed by Governor Andrew Cuomo 30 days ago took effect Wednesday, partially decriminalizing marijuana possession in the state again. Residents across New York State can publicly possess or smoke up to 2 ounces of marijuana without criminal penalties. Now a violation similar to a traffic ticket, the maximum penalty is $50 for possessing less than 1 ounce of pot and a maximum of $200 for between 1 and 2 ounces. The violation is still serious enough to remain on a person's record and can affect being hired at some jobs. But still, 150,000 people arrested for marijuana will have their convictions sealed under the new law. Cuomo said the bill is the start of a new chapter in the criminal justice system and is long overdue. The executive and legal director of Empire State Normal, the state affiliate of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, is David Holland.
It didn't really become legal. It became further decriminalized. Marijuana up to a certain amount could be lawfully possessed as just a, well, not lawfully, but could be possessed under 25 grams. It would just be a violation, which was not a crime. This week, new legislation went into effect and increased the amounts of personal possession that an individual could have, up to with the fine up to 1 ounce being $50 and up to 2 ounces being $200.
What about the other provisions of this new law?
There were two aspects of it. One was the decriminalization part of it, which we just discussed, and the other was expungement, which was to clear the records of those, and it looks to be about 200,000 or so that will readily be impacted, to remove marijuana convictions that were a crime from their records so that it will not harm them in future opportunities to seek employment and in housing and in loans and things of that nature.
Why is that such a problem, getting the expungement? I heard that that was the sticking point.
I think there were several sticking points in New York's quest to have legalization, which was unsuccessful, what the governor had tried to push through in January. Expungement, I don't think, was the most controversial topic, but some people are going to have those convictions removed from their records, but other people may still face convictions going forward, provided if they were part of violent crime or other things. So if they were found in possession while holding a gun or things like that, they may not be immediately subject to expungement. And that's an issue that was not fully resolved as far as I'm aware.
And what are some of the other sticking points?
The problem was this. The governor in January tried to push legalization through in his budget bill, which was unsuccessful, and then the legislature tried to come to its own negotiations over different bills that would legalize. That would have allowed for commerce to take place. People would be able to apply for licenses to grow and process and sell regulated cannabis. The big issue was that there was part of that was supposed to be social equity, that people wanted, there had been many communities that had been terribly impacted by the war on drugs, and particularly the over-prosecution, or as I call it, the over-persecution of cannabis, which led to the decimation of adults in the communities that went away for various periods of times for jail and so forth, and in turn struck their opportunities away from them to get gainful employment and in housing and so forth. So there was a real social consciousness that was part of what the governor wanted, which was the social equity program to provide training and other benefits for people that had been victims of the drug war. But there was not clear-cut guidance on how those funds would be fully extracted and implemented in those communities. And that was the real big sticking point on legalization. So as a result, a compromise was reached to further decriminalize. But much like Zeno's paradox, where if you go only halfway, you never get to the destination, this is just a halfway measure, if not a half-assed measure.
Is there work going forward to try and solve these problems? The first thing that comes to mind is that the tobacco companies and the liquor companies want to get in on this, and they don't want it to be turned into a liberal welfare program, and let's start making money. Is that what the problem is?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think that while there are big industries that have an interest in it, New York's program was very much geared towards trying to use those social equity funds to create opportunities for people to gain entrance at all different aspects of the market, to be able to get licenses and be part of the booming industry. New York also wanted to prevent, other than with the medical register organizations that are out there, nobody could own the entire process, meaning nobody could plant the seeds and then farm them and process them and sell them. You could only be involved. You couldn't both grow it and sell it.
Well, California has the same problem. When I talk to folks out in California, they say they can't get licensed. It's supposedly legal, but nobody can get a license.
California's difference is that it does allow vertical integration so that you can grow it and sell it. New York, by breaking up that type of monopoly, means that more people have to be involved in the process, and therefore the concentration of money is not the determining factor like it is in California for lots of those people that are getting the licenses. So it will be more inclusive of, as an industry rather than less inclusive.
Do you think they're making progress in New York? Is this going to be solved?
Oh, I think it is. I think it's inevitable, and some of that inevitability comes from the fact that all of the presidential candidates, including Donald Trump, have already spoken in some degree about legalization and their being in favor of it, either as a states' rights issue or a federally repealed as far as the Controlled Substances Act. So New York, I think, is very close, and the votes on legalization this past year were only a few votes apart. So times have changed and attitudes have changed, and we as the advocate community like NORML and other Drug Policy Alliance and so forth now know what the concerns of the people are so we can better address them for the upcoming legislative session. And hopefully we'll have a law on the books fairly soon. And if not, I believe the governor will push it again in his budget bill in January.
All right, great. Thanks a lot. I keep thinking, though, there's going to be DEA agents at every border, like arresting people for what's legal if they just dare go out into the next state over.
I understand that, but part of the federal law now says that federal agents can't use federal funds to go after people that are in compliance with a state program, whether it's adult use or whether it's medical. So it's really just one state against another, and these issues are going to be resolved in time.
David Holland is Executive and Legal Director of Empire State NORML, the state affiliate of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. In local news, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez held a town hall last night at the New York City Housing Authority facility in the Bronx. She focused on NYCHA issues, including their one-strike policy that can lead to the eviction of tenants for possession of marijuana.
It went even a step further, where if you had a guest come over, if you had a friend over, and that friend on their way out was caught with a dime bag of weed in your pocket, you got evicted too, even though it was your friend. And guess what? Those laws are still on the books today. They were never rescinded, which is why we've introduced legislation to rescind one strike, to rescind the one strike policy. So we'll go forward. So NYCHA today, as we know, is part of a huge conversation, and this is really what we want to set the ground for today. We're not interested in kind of having a one-way conversation telling you what things should be. We really want to make sure that our policy is bottom-up, that it's informed and led by NYCHA residents and families that are impacted and our communities that are impacted, but also that we gather to figure out what housing as a human right looks like on a federal level. Because I believe that we, decades ago, abandoned our commitment to housing as a right. And for 30 years, we've put profits over people and the ability for people to make money over someone's right to a decent, dignified home. And so what we want to do and what we are committed to doing is turning that ship around. And the first thing that we have to do is set down a vision for the country. And when we set down that vision, then we can start building up those small policies one by one to achieve it. So NYCHA today, the two previous decades of federal investment have exacerbated conditions at NYCHA. A lot of people don't know, but since 2001, NYCHA has suffered more than $2.7 billion in cuts from the federal government each year. Each year. So if you own a house, and if you grew up in a house, or if you own your apartment, every year you make small investments to maintain and upkeep your home. You may have to replace, replace your parts of your roof, you may have to paint the walls, you may have to swap out your sink. It probably costs about $1,000 to $2,000 in a couple grand in upkeeping your home every year. But we have the same needs in our public housing stock. As a lot of people know, we need to replace our pipes. We need to make sure that our heating systems are working. And each year, that takes a small investment. Well, since 2001, for many of those years, they've been run by a Republican-controlled Congress, or Republicans have controlled one of two or one of both of those bodies, the Senate or the House. And so as a result, since 2001, Congress has not been implementing those couple thousand dollars worth a year in your home, which would be about $2.7 billion for our entire housing stock. We have per year. And so what that has done since 2001, when you don't invest little by little in each year, you end up with huge problems. Just like with your home, if you don't invest in those little, in that little upkeep, or your car, if you don't invest in a tune-up every year, your whole system will become broken. And it'll become much more expensive to fix it than if you just maintained it the entire time. And that's what's been done with our public housing stock. In my opinion, it's a form of federal sabotage of our housing stock, because the intention is to break it so much that we then want to convince people to throw it away. But I do not think that public housing is a commitment that we should throw away. I think it's one that we should invest in.
Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking at a town hall in the Bronx on Thursday night. And finally, more than 100 members of Congress denounced an abrupt and publicly an unannounced move by the Trump administration to shutter a program that has shielded hundreds of seriously ill immigrants and their families from deportation while they receive life-saving medical treatment in the U.S. The contingent of Democratic lawmakers from both the House and Senate penned a letter on Friday to top officials at the Department of Homeland Security, urging them to reverse course and continue offering these immigrants, including children with life-threatening health conditions, a temporary reprieve from deportation through a U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services program known as Medical Deferred Action. The decision to end the program, quote, will needlessly endanger vulnerable children and families nationwide while seeking medical deferments for individuals receiving life-saving treatment for serious illness, the lawmakers wrote. And that's some of the news for Friday, August 30th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jessica Brockington. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.